You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie for Solidarity Breakfast on your 3CR community radio station. And today we're going to have a few extended headlines, really. The first one is a note that the Global Samud Fotila, featuring Zach Schofield, Ethan Floyd and Jaden Kitchener, set off from Gadigal land, Sydney, on April the 8th. And ahead of that, they did a media conference, which was covered by Green Left, the Socialist Alliance newspaper. They've got it, the full 24-minute press conference on their YouTube channel, but I thought I'd give you just a little snippet so that you can hear the reason for why some of these people have joined up to take supplies to the Palestinians who are in the grip of the insidious hands of the IDF.
I'm going on the Global Samud Flotilla because students have always been at the front lines of social movements the world over, from the freedom rides here in Australia, to the mobilisation to end the war in Vietnam, to boycotts against South African apartheid, and protests against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Students have always been ready and willing to step up and speak out. And myself, I'm a student at the University of Sydney and a member of Students for Palestine. I think what's important about this flotilla is that it is a visible, public, physical action to break Israel's illegal naval blockade of Gaza, which continues to deny Palestinians much-needed aid to which they are entitled under international law. But of course, we must remember that this does not begin, nor does it end, with Israel's illegal naval blockade of Gaza, and that while we are away on the flotilla, there is a vital role for people back home to play in continuing to pressure our government to take steps such as expelling the Israeli ambassador and backing that up with sanctions, political and economic, on the state of Israel. And also pressuring our institutions, our universities, to cut ties with the weapons companies and warmongers which use students' money and students' research in the commission of war crimes around the world. And Zach is exactly right, that if we can arrest Ben Robert Smith for committing war crimes, we should apply that same standard to the state of Israel. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Raju Marangaya. I'll be dropping on this flotilla for a few reasons. But one of the main reasons is I think about them babies over there. Those babies that are dying of hypothermia, babies that are dying of hunger, babies that don't have their basic needs met. Not at a fault of their own, but at the fault of Israel, who does not let aid come in there, who does not protect these babies, and who actively kills and bombs these babies. In Aboriginal culture, we believe that all children, all babies are sacred. We believe that we have a responsibility to look after them babies, to take care of those babies. That is a simple reason, but a strong reason.
A strong reason to be part of the Global Samud Fotila. There was, as I said, a media conference that was covered by Green Left, a as the flotilla left Gadigal country, Sydney, on April the 8th. You can get the full 24 minutes of that media of event on Green Left's YouTube channel. I've got another large report, actually, about another event that happened just this week. You might not, it may not have entered your radar, but there's been a long drawn out campaign to ensure that Adriana Riveras, an ex-secret police agent from Chile during the Pinochet era, who has made her home in Australia, be extradited to Chile for to face trial for some of her crimes, facing seven counts of aggravated kidnapping in the country. We've got a report around the events that have led to the campaign and the work that people have been doing for a very long time to finally get a result from the federal court this week that says that Riveras should be sent back to all hurdles have been passed to send Riveras back to Chile to face justice. She has one very slim ability to appeal, but it has to be on a point of law, and it appears that that's clutching at straws. This is a report put together by Karina Adeo Aguilera about the extradition proceedings against Adriana Riveras, which gives all the details of the affair.
Adriana Rivas, ex-secret police agent in Chile during the time of the dictatorship, facing seven counts of aggravated kidnapping in the country, has been appealing extradition requests in Australian courts for several years now. The most recent of her appeal attempts saw the federal court in Sydney on the 30th and 31st of March this year and was presided over by Justice Michael Lee. In question was the 2024 decision which authorised her surrender to Chilean authorities, which was made by the Australian Finance Minister, whom Rivas argued had exceeded her powers back in 2024 with this decision. In this recent appeal, Rivas also emphasised an interpretation of the extradition treaty, claiming the minister's decision was based on an incorrect characterisation of the crimes attributed to her. That is, those offences, properly characterised, constituted crimes against humanity rather than aggravated kidnapping. And that since such offences didn't exist in Australian or Chilean law at the time the criminal acts occurred, they were therefore time-barred. On the second day of this round of proceedings, court was adjourned, with Justice Lee giving his final ruling a week later on the 7th of April. In his ruling, he held there was no sound basis for the review sought by Rivas. The minister had correctly applied the law. He also ordered that Ms. Rivas pay the legal costs to the minister. Today we'll hear some words from family members of the victims residing in Chile, recorded after Justice Lee's final decision, just this week on the 7th of April. But first, some dispatches from Pilar Aguilera, 3CR volunteer and member of a community group called the National Campaign for Truth and Justice in Chile. Pilar, having covered this story for some time now, was able to capture some of the initial reactions of campaign members and other supporters outside the federal court at the end of March, prior to the final judgment. Here she is now with some background.
Who is Adriana Rivas? She worked in the secret police, the DINA, the National Intelligence Directorate, in the 1970s in Chile during the dictatorship. She was part of a secret squad called the Lautaro Brigade, an elite squad whose mission was to exterminate the opposition during the dictatorship, mainly communists. They worked in a secret barracks called Simón Bolívar in Santiago, which was a detention and torture centre, essentially an extermination centre, which wasn't made public because there were no survivors. and its existence was only verified in 2007, 2008 by Jorge Lino Vergara, who had worked there as a young waiter in this barracks and testified of its existence. In 2006, Adriana Rivas was arrested in Chile and put under house arrest. A few years later, she fled illegally, left the country and arrived back in Australia. In 2014, Chile made an extradition request to Australia, and in February 2019, she was arrested and has remained in custody ever since. In 2020, the High Court ruled that, in fact, Adriana Rivas could be extradited to Chile. Since then, she'd made multiple appeals to various courts in Australia and were awaiting the final decision by Justice Lee of this latest hearing held on the 30th and 31st of March in the New South Wales Federal Court.
Here at the Court of New South Wales, entering the hearing for Adriana Rivas, hoping that Justice Lee will make a final decision on this outcome in a positive way for us and the families of the seven victims.
Our organisation works closely with the families of the seven victims, and they're awaiting justice. They want the day when Adriana Rivas can be extradited back to Chile to face the Chilean courts for the seven counts of aggravated kidnapping that she's accused of. At this point, I'd like to also mention the names of the seven victims. Reinalda Pereira, who was 6 months pregnant at the time of her disappearance. Fernando Navarro, Lincoln Berrios, Horacio Cepeda, Juan Fernando Ortiz, Héctor Vélez, and Víctor Díaz, all leaders of the Communist Party who've been missing since 1976. We don't forgive, we don't forget. We demand justice.
We've left the court on the second day, 31st of March, and unfortunately Justice Lee has reserved his decision. It's a little bit disappointing, but we are hoping still for a positive outcome to this extradition case of Adriana Rivas.
I'm going to record a few words now for our community radio station 3CR Melbourne. We've just left the courthouse and just looking for some first impressions. Comrade, you were telling me just a little moment ago.
The only thing I hope for is that the decision they make on Thursday will be favourable, that justice will be served, because what hurts the most is the mockery they make of our dead. That's what hurts me the most.
Well, I agree with what Carlos said. Since 2014, we have been coming out and we will keep coming out until this case is finished. And we hope that this happens favourably and that this woman goes to Chile to pay for her crimes.
We don't have a choice but to wait patiently. We have waited far too long, and to remain optimistic, believing that she will return to Chile, will provide the information that the families of the detained disappeared need. Thank you.
I think that the families, above all, expect justice, because it's not a matter of revenge, it's about truth and justice, as our group, which is here supporting the extradition, says. So we await the judge's decision.
And one of the things I also think is that she, Adriana Rivas, was personal secretary to Contreras, the head of the secret police during the dictatorship. So she would have access to a lot of information. What do you think about that?
Well, the families, including me, I have a disappeared person in my family, are waiting for someone to say where they are and what happened to them. We know now that they're not coming back, but we want to know exactly what happened. Because it's one thing to know, to be able to grieve and perform the rites of passage the family deems appropriate, and another thing entirely to not know. That's part of justice, knowing where they are. So far, they've remained silent. It's a conspiracy of silence.
Pilar Aguilera with some of the first impressions of campaigners and supporters outside the federal court in Sydney on the 31st of March. Carlos Mendoza, Nadia Rivera, Juanita Mendoza, Mariluz Escudero and Ketty Montero. Now moving to some more recent reflections recorded on the 7th of April following Justice Lee's ruling. Thanks to Pilar and the tireless work of the National Campaign for Truth and Justice in Chile.
Today, 7th of April at 10:15, Federal Court Justice Michael Lee dismissed a final legal challenge from Adriana Rivas, a former Sydney nanny accused of kidnapping and torture during the Pinochet regime, clearing the path for her extradition to Chile. Justice Lee found no legal error in the Australian government's decisions to extradite her. He rejected arguments from her legal team that she might face the death penalty, which Australia does not extradite for and does no longer exist in Chile.
Some of the responses following this ruling from family members of the victims residing in Chile.
First, we'll hear from Maria Luisa Ortiz, daughter of Fernando Ortiz.
To begin with, we deeply appreciate how quickly the ruling was delivered because we have been on a long journey of many years requesting the initiation of this extradition process by the Chilean state. Us, the families, the lawyers, everyone who has supported us and the support group. That is the first thing. We did not have to wait any longer for the decision. Secondly, the ruling shows that the extradition must take place as it should. She fled this country while under prosecution, went to Australia, gave interviews defending her role in the DINA, and now must return to Chile to face justice for the kidnappings of our family members. This year marks 50 years since they were detained by the DINA, the secret police in Chile, and we hope that this year Adriana Rivas will indeed return to Chile to face the judicial process for the detention and disappearance of our relatives.
Now, Maria Estela Ortiz, also daughter of Fernando Ortiz.
I would add that after our relatives were kidnapped, they were immediately taken to the Simón Bolívar Extermination Centre, of which Adriana Rivas was a part. She was among those who not only participated in their persecution, but who also tortured and killed our family members. Reinalda was there. She was 5 months pregnant with her first child. I think it must be said that each of these days has been filled with deep pain. Therefore, as Licha was saying, Licha is her sister, Maria Luisa Ortiz. There has also been a process in which the solidarity and brotherhood of Chileans in exile in Sydney has truly meant immeasurable support for us. Each one of them, holding photos of our relatives, has accompanied us throughout this entire period. And that is something wonderful, because we have not been able to travel or be there, which is something we would have deeply wished.
Pamela Berrios, daughter of Lincoln Berrios.
These are just emotions, in case they might be of any use. Today has been a day deeply connected to my father. I went to collect his file from the search plan and reread the first written descriptions by my mother. I had seen them before, but it's like realizing that we have spent 50 years on this path, one that has had very difficult moments, very many difficult moments. But it has also brought us together as families, as this large family we have, always willing to keep moving forward. That perseverance of ours, of continuing the fight. This group was the first to be assigned an investigating judge. We spent 3 months at Cuesta, there every day. We have fought for every ruling that has been processed, and we will continue because we are convinced that at some point justice must be done for our families, and that this will also allow progress in finding all our comrades who were detained and disappeared.
And a listener's note that La Cuesta in this case refers to one of the many sites in Chile where detained, disappeared people's remains were found and where family members continue searching for evidence of their loved ones.
The National Campaign for Truth and Justice Chile was formed in September 2013. It began as a small group initiated by four people. It became a larger group over the years, but then people dropped out and it ended up being the four people who initially set it up. Marta Olea, Elizabeth Rivera, Ivan Donato and myself, Pilar Aguilera. So we've been working on this extradition case since 2013. At first, we weren't allowed to speak about it. It had to be very secret. We weren't allowed to divulge any information and we learnt a lot about extradition law, the treaty that exists between Chile and Australia, and about different legal processes. 12 years later, we are here and hopefully she will be extradited back to Chile soon.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. De pie cantar que vamos a triunfar. Avanzan ya banderas de unidad. Y tú vendrás marchando junto a mí. Y así verás tu canto y tu bandera. Y ahora el pueblo que se alza en la lucha con voz de gigante gritando adelante. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. La patria está forjando la unidad. De norte a sur se movilizará.
You're with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, your community radio station, and we're going to move on to Voices for Palestine. At the recent Marxist conference, there was a session called Defending Palestine and Civil Liberties, and one of the people speaking was Mohammed Baba. He's an Israeli Arab film producer, and he was describing his life as part of the Israeli state. He, as an Arab Israeli, is a second-class citizen in his own country, but he goes on to discuss some of the issues for Palestinians in general. He's got a film that's being screened, a special screening at Kino on Saturday the 18th of April at 4 p.m. There's going to be a Q&A with the filmmaker and one of the producers. It's called Two Kids a Day and it focuses on Israelis' arrest and treatment of Palestinian children. This is what Mohammed had to say at the Marxist conference during Easter.
But without further ado, I want to introduce our first speaker, who is Mohammed Babai,
Mohammed was born in Jaffa, Palestine. He is a film producer, and as a film producer, Mohammed wanted to document the injustices that the Palestinian people face under occupation and continue with this work through his film producing. We're very lucky to have him here with us today. Please give him a very warm welcome.
As she told you, I'm from Palestine. I'm from Jaffa. What's it called? Palestinian 48. I have Israeli citizenship. And today I would like to talk about a few laws in the only democracy in the Middle East with the most moral army in the world. I guess you all know what I'm talking about. And we as Palestinian, me as a Palestinian on paper were Israeli citizenship. But our experience shaped by our distinct ethnicities. The Israeli regime frequently highlights this difference through the implementation of new laws or the enforcement of existing ones, impacting our status and experience within the state. Past 2.5 years, things shifted to the worse for all Palestinians in Palestine, and today I would like to talk about us as Palestinian 48 and about the dozens of Israeli specific, about Israeli's law specific, neutralize us as activists or as Palestinian citizens who try to speak out for our own people, like the genocide in Gaza. And as you all know, Israeli regime don't hide anything, their intention for genocide or for the displacement of people like in the refugees camp in the West Bank or the killing of Palestinian people. I want to talk about the last law that everybody heard about it, about the death law, which was enacted for Palestinian, specifically Palestinian in the West Bank. One of the definitions of the law is death penalty for someone who commit a terror attack, which is meant to threaten the existence of Israeli state of Jewish people. You don't need to be a law expert to understand what they mean and for whom. Even without this law, Israeli regime have been torturing and killing Palestinians and prisoners since 48. They don't need this law to kill Palestinians. In the past 2 years, 100 Palestinian prisoners were killed in the torture camps by Israeli regime. And of course, you know, there's almost 9,000 prisoners in the Israeli prison, and among them 3,500 under administrative detention. By the way, this law is far way back at the time of the British mandate, like the death law. One of the basic law, Israeli law, is the Israeli law, like Israeli national state of Jewish people, which means the Hebrew is the official language. Only Israeli, Jew Israeli, have the self-determination, and also they have the right to develop development of the Jewish settlement as a national values. That means that we as a Palestinian native people have no right for self-determination, or have no right to have our new cities or villages or to build or other rights. Of course, Arabic language is not an official language anymore. So, as I told you, there is a diverse way to killing Palestinians, like a bombing, assassination, as you all witness in the West Bank in the middle of the day. They can come, assassinate, and take the body of the Palestinian, or they can enter his house, assassinate the Palestinian in front of his family, or they carpet bomb, like they did in Gaza, torture prisoners, prevent medical treatment, or beat them to death. I wanna start with a few laws that that enforced in the last 2.5 years. I wanna start with the Nakba law. The law is designed to prevent Palestinians from speaking about the Nakba, and defining event in Palestinian history critical to Palestinian collective national identity. And they do it in a variety of contexts, including education. It has chilling effect on educators, organizers, and activists, preventing them from speaking openly about the Palestinian history and culture, and from voicing legitimate criticism of the state. Of course, we are not allowed to put keffiyeh in Palestine, or to dare to have posters of kids in Gaza who were killed, or Palestinian flag. The law imposed severe and unjustified restrictions on freedom of expression and explicitly targeted Palestinians. This law entrenched Jewish supremacy in important public spaces by withdrawing state funding from institutions that challenged the definition of the state as a Jewish state. The second law is the law of a land and planning right law. This amendment of law prevents any person or entity, like a private or public entity, from selling land or leasing property for a period of exchange exceeding 5 years. That means you can't sell your land to any foreigners. And of course, this is the law, how it's written, but in fact means that no Palestinian who live, a refugee, can't buy any land in Palestine. You are not allowed to sell, or you are not allowed to buy it. The point of this law is to prevent Palestinians who have money or able to buy even their own house that was evicted from it, like his grandparents, they're not allowed to buy it back. Even in some Palestinians have the paper that approve the owner of this property. They're not allowed to buy it. Also, there is the law of further amendment. This is the law of prison ordinance that was enacted in May, allowing restriction on security prisoners. And I'm talking about Palestinian with Israeli citizenship, and I'm talking Palestinian in the West Bank. It's a different story. They are under military rules and laws. Under the new law, the director of security service may limit the number of lawyers permitted to visit prisoners or group of prisoners to a period of 3 months and extend the period for an additional 3 months with approval of the Attorney General. And of course, I know many occasions that they extended for more 6 months and they don't need any proof to ask to extend it. And there is also the law of family unification. It's a law specific for us. That means, like, if I have Israeli citizenship, I get married to someone from the West Bank, she is not allowed to live with me in my city, in Jaffa. And if we have a baby, the baby have no rights. I can have my baby with me until the age of 14, then I need to send him back to the West Bank because he have no rights. Imagine if one of you come to Israeli regime and get married, you might have Israeli citizenship. For example, if I get married to an Australian woman, not Jew, it will take more time. Not like if she's a Jew, it will be easy. Automatically she got citizenship. But non-Jewish people, it will take many years. Palestinian, no way. So we are not allowed even to get married to a Palestinian from the West Bank, unless I go and live there. And the best one, my favorite law, is the Thought Law. This law is the Thought Law. It's in all Israel referred to a controversial amendment to the country's controversial law passed in November 23, which criminalized the system and the conditions, conceptions of a publication of a terrorist organization. Easy. For example, if I sit in my house, in my room, I watch videos for Hamas or Hezbollah or other organization, only watch. And a friend and another guy see that I'm watching many videos, he can go and call the police and tell them that Muhammad is watching a lot of videos. And of course, if I watch a lot without even sharing, before sharing the videos, I can get arrested. Because they assume that if I watch a lot of videos, I'm gonna have intention to do and to commit a terror attack. So even in your own house, you have no rights to watch videos or any videos that you want to watch. And I remember during the genocide, many, specifically in Jerusalem, they used to stop young guys or get into a store and ask the guys to open their phone and to check if they are member on Telegram and other groups who talk about the genocide in Gaza. So they have two choices. Or they open the phone and they check. If they are part of or member in a group, they can take the phone and beat them. Or they can say no. So when they say no, they arrest them, they beat them, they take the phone, And most of the time, they just take their phone and they don't get it back. And they do it because they can do it. They can do whatever they want. They don't need any law to do that. There is also one more thing I want to talk about the Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian prisoners have no rights, of course. But also after he gets killed or died in prison, his body is not released. For example, if he got detained for 20 years and he died after 10 years, so they will hold his body for more 10 years. He's a prisoner after his death. And because most of the world treat Israel regime like a Western democratic regime, but they are not. It's not that the Western countries they are democratic. We know exactly how they treat people in Germany who dare to speak out, how they ban people. So it's happening for Palestinians. It's been like this for more than 70 years, but now in the past 2 years after the genocide and the world standing aside and doing nothing, so the Israeli regime know that they can do whatever they want and nobody will tell them to stop it. So this is our reality as a Palestinian who have Israeli citizenship. Thank you.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Song of broken hearts. The
on Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, your community radio station. And that was a tune from The Bachelorette and The Earth Knew Absence. We're going to change gear now. We're going to have a little dip into the Comedy Festival. Melbourne has been taken over. Unless you've been living under a rock, you'll be aware that it's been taken over again by the Melbourne International Comedy Festival that runs for another full week to Sunday, April the 19th. If you're wondering which show to pick, I got to chat briefly with award-winning UK comedian Luke McQueen, who is showing at Acme's Grandel Lab with his show Comedian's Comedian, and also a little snippet from a chat with Sam Jay from America, who's playing We the People at the Cloakroom at the Melbourne Town Hall. Now, it seems to me that you have bitten off a huge amount when you say that you do an expose of ambition, artificial intelligence, and if you could still find honesty in the digital age. Tell me about how you built this show of yours.
Well, there's a podcast called The Comedian's Comedian, which is a podcast in the UK hosted by Stuart Goldsmith, and he interviews comedians about their careers and their sort of process. I've never been on it. I've never been asked to be on it. So I, obviously with new technology, you don't sort of need to be asked to be on shows. So, because you can just clone people's voices.
Oh.
So I used AI to clone his voice, and now I'm doing the podcast without him. I mean, I could have actually done this interview without you, to be fair.
But yeah. So except you don't know me.
You could have done it without me. And then in terms of the other stuff, you know, obviously I'm talking about, you know, I'm talking about my career, my process, but I'm in control of the questions and the answers. And I suppose the argument that I make in the show is that there isn't a lot of honesty online, because, you know, you're always expressing yourself with the knowledge that thousands of people are watching or listening. So you're not being honest. You're thinking about how you're coming across.
Well, which I suppose in a sense is not very different from the past as well. I mean, I remember, because I'm old, and I remember when mobile phones became normalised, and I can remember standing in a elevator and watching how long it took a person to remove the sense of embarrassment, social embarrassments that's normal, diverting it to their phone. And now people don't realise that's what they're doing, because I was thinking the other day, there is no public space because of phones.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's just totally changed the way we exist. I mean, I grew up in a tiny little village in Bedfordshire, in sort of just north of London. When you grow up in a village, it's a similar. It's not quite as extreme, but you know, everyone knows each other, so your behaviour is different if you obviously grew up in a city. And I think that's the world that we live in now. It's like we're all in a little village, you know, because of how connected we are.
Do you find that by being a stand-up comedian, or even using comedy to be able to express some of these ideas, that it makes it gets through the door, you know, in people's minds, as it were, in a way that they wouldn't normally appreciate?
I think so. That's the challenge, to articulate how you feel in a creative way. And, you know, I don't know. I think basically it does, yeah. Whether it sticks with people depends on the individual. And also people will take different things away from the show. It's not as if it's like I'm sort of hammering that message home for the whole show, but it's certainly part of it. It's certainly something that I believe. I mean, I don't expect that this show is going to change the world, but yeah, maybe it will change some individuals. You know, the world is that way now, and you can afraid adapt to it or die. I mean, in the creative industry, it's difficult not to be sort of online constantly. And if you don't do that, it's very hard now to have a profile and build a following.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. It's just that the AI business is a double-edged sword.
because once a falsity is engendered and repeated and repeated and repeated, it becomes the truth.
Yeah.
Do you find that people are laughing at your jokes?
Yeah, I hope so.
How many shows have you done yet, or are you just starting?
Well, I did the show in Edinburgh and London and a few dates around the UK. So before I come to Melbourne, I'd already done the show probably about 40 times. And now in Melbourne, I've just done just over 2 weeks.
And you've got another couple of weeks to go, and it's at Acme at the Grendel Lab.
Do 7:45. On Sunday at 6:45, because Sunday everyone does their shows an hour earlier.
So tell me, are you finding that there's a difference in reactions from, say, Edinburgh, London, Melbourne?
There's a difference because I've got an audience that knows me in Edinburgh and London. So, you know, when you start the show, there's an element of excitement, you know, because people know me. They know what to expect from my shows a little bit. So in that sense, it makes it easier. So in Melbourne, it's my first time, so an audience is discovering me, which is exciting. You know, it's new. It's not something I've had to go through for a long time. And what it means basically is that, you know, there's some people there, and on a good night, you know, sort of most of them are into it. But there have been some nights where not all the audience, you know, there's people in the room that maybe wouldn't connect with what I'm doing. But I think the show has got a really good narrative. So even if you don't sort of connect with the humour, there is like quite a good, there's a good narrative there. So I think by the end, everybody walks out, you know, largely pretty happy and satisfied.
Okay, Sam, thanks for taking some time to talk to me out of your busy comedian's job during a Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Can you tell me a little bit about We the People? Tell me about it.
It's kind of just me talking about the current state of the world, just kind of politically what we're seeing, and talking about it more to like how we're feeling about all of it rather than kind of the more technical aspect of what's happening, but like why I think it's happening. Speaking to that stuff from a more space of people's emotions and feelings.
Well, that's a perfect thing for comedy to handle, really, isn't it? Because, you know, as a black woman from America, not feeling that much part of your country, but watching it go down the gurgler is a painful experience, or that requires a bit of laughter in order to get you through.
I mean, I don't know if it requires laughter, but laughter helps, you know. But, like, a part of comedy is always to put sugar with the medicine. So, you know, I feel like laughter helps all these things go down.
You've deliberately called it We the People. That's almost a call to arms, isn't it? Or is it really identifying with all of us?
I guess you could look at it either way. I think it's a bit of a double entendre. It's part of it to me that it's just like we the people are collectively going through this, not an individual thing. We the people are going through this right now, currently. But I think you could also look at it as a call to arms. Excuse me one second.
How are you finding Australian audiences with your material?
I mean, I feel like it's pretty universal, you know? I feel like we're kind of all feeling and experiencing the same thing to some degree. I also think the internet just makes the world a smaller place, so it hasn't felt like they can't relate or connect.
You're at the town hall on a big stage, are you, or in one of the side rooms?
Oh, I'm in one of the side rooms. I'm in the cloakroom, so.
Oh, right. Okay. Nice. So it's quite close and intimate.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right. And that's quite nice, really, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm enjoying it. It's a cool space. I'm just on one show a day, and I have Mondays off.
And is this the first time you've come to Melbourne?
No, this is my second time. I've done this festival before, like maybe 5 years ago. I came with two of my colleagues in comedy, and we were doing the headliner showcase, which I don't think they used to do, like, with the Americans, and we all do, like, 30 minutes. But I don't really remember it. It was kind of all a blur because I was only here for, like, 5 days. So by the time I got jet-lagged and stuff, it was time to turn around and go home.
It's a long way, isn't it?
Yeah. The flight is something wicked, but it's been really nice to be here for an extended period and really take in the culture. This has been a Maoli show in Australia, so if you want to see me, you gotta come to the town hall.
And so tell me, what's the reaction of the audience to? Are you getting lots of laughs? Is it working, your material?
Yeah. I think it's working. It seems to be resonating. People are laughing. It seems like, you know, I'm getting good reception, I would say. It's kind of hard to ask me. Like, yeah. I think I'm always kind of, like, judging myself, but I think people are digging it.
How do you as a because it's such a big affair, the comedy festival, how do you get booked to be a comedian through in this event?
I don't know. they reached out and said, you know, they'd like me to come do the show after, like, some of the bookers saw it in Edinburgh, and I guess they enjoyed it.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that's right. You're a bit of a hot property, aren't you?
I wouldn't know, brother. I have no idea. I just show up and tell the jokes.
Yeah, but you've won awards, and you've also got a couple of Netflix shows, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, man. I've been a comic for 13 years, and so I've done some things, if you know, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, no, I think you could seriously consider yourself to be successful, and it would be worth people's while to buy a ticket and go down to the town hall. What time are you on, except on Mondays?
I'm on at 7:40 and 6:40 on Sunday, so an hour early on Sundays, 7:40. You know, I've been really enjoying performing this show for the Melbourne audiences, and you know, I do think it's worth a gander.
G'day, my name is Margie Thorpe. You are listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 on your dial.
A week solidarity, Brickney team listener. When we'll kick off with an easy question. Well, easy answer to an easy question. When is a ceasefire not a real ceasefire? And yes, I'm sure we all got it. Of course. When Zion is involved. After all, when constant trained killing is all that stands between you and a jail cell and ensures your Yahweh-given right to all the land from the river to the sea and beyond, what choice does an alleged war criminal have? It's imperative, of course, that all other parties, the evil terrorist parties, abide by the ceasefire that, for them, is a ceasefire, and Pakistan, which orchestrated this Iran ceasefire, and evil Iran said Lebanon was included. But when Zion continued its slaughter and destruction and displacement, Supremo Benjamin, not another Yahoo, said it certainly was not. And the US of the UN of the US of the world said it agreed with Benjamin, but Vice Supremo J.P. Dunce said Zion would not slaughter, destroy and displace quite as much. Whatever the hell that drivel meant, which must have been music to the Lebanese people's ears. Because for poor evading that prison cell Benjamin, ceasefire is a dirty word. Why? We recall only a couple of years ago, then-caring business-class party supremo and would-be big supremo, Constable Peter Duffer, remember him? told Parliament in yet another forceful attack on the socialists that ceasefire is anti-Semitic. Like, you know, anti that thing like, with Benjamin nodding agreement. Not that the socialists needed any encouragement to support Benjamin's slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation of the non-land, non-people of Gaza. And this week, caring business class party shadowy, being offensive and trained killing spokesperson James Potbem's son said, here I thought for the first time ever, he may say something with which we could agree, but no, true to form, said we cannot trust the word of evil, evil Iran, or presumably therefore Pakistan, and we must believe, can believe, our great ally, the US of, which would never, ever tell a lie. And well, given its long, long track record and the most recent track record of Big Supremo Donald Trample the Poor, He's got plenty of proof to back up that confident assertion. And yesterday, his counterpart, our very own Minister for Being Offensive and Train Killing, Richard Malls the Bad Guys, he of the giant mind, supported James. He was taking the US OBS word about destroying evil Iran's nuclear ambitions. He too knows the US OBS would never tell a lie. Is that the total destruction of their nuclear capacity when the US OBS and Zion bombed them last year, Richard, or the total destruction of their nuclear capacity when the US OBS and Zion is bombing them this year, or will the total destruction be complete when they bomb them next year or next week or the week after? Could you repeat the question? I think you've answered it, Richard. They say the first casualty of war is truth, but my word, don't Benjamin and Donald put a lie to that. And if war is hell, back here, all hell broke loose when former big-time train killer Ben Roberts Smite Them was arrested for alleged war crimes. Oh, how by the end of day one of that protracted defamation case he must have so regretted suing. All hell broke loose, because how dare a national hero who trained, killed Afghans for his country to protect us from an Afghan invasion be charged for just doing his job. The hurt of this injustice would be tugging at all our heartstrings. Former Big Supremo Little Johnny Howhard, who sent Ben off to kill and be killed, spoke for all of us. While our very filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Gina, questioned the merit of investigating and prosecuting special forces trained killers who, after all, are trained to train kill with a little finger. Like many true blue Aussies, I hope that compassion and the Aussie spirit is extended to Ben and his family. She spoke for so many of us. And Gina epitomises all there is about compassion and the Aussie spirit, although she will neither confirm nor deny she helped fund Ben's massive defamation costs or whether she will fund his war crimes defence. But as government, heeding the wise warnings of the caring business class, moves to slash spending on people with disabilities, among other necessary cuts, many of those abraded by the injustice of throwing poor Ben into a prison cell argue the public purse should fund his defence because he was killing for all of us. The public, the Crown charges him, then pays for his defence against itself. Perhaps Gina could offer to fund the prosecution, then hand the brief to a first-year law student. Although, and this is hypothetical, because as we know, Ben has the right to the presumption of innocence, but if the charges prove correct, at what point does any government responsibility cease? Another ex-Special Forces trained killer said Ben had served with honour and distinction. Don't they all? As they kill with honour, kill with distinction. See, there's all these rules, the Geneva Convention, about how to kill and be killed, but whether they kill with honour or dishonour, with distinction or disrepute, matters little, I think we can be sure, to the dead. A terrible, untrue Lavoisie thought. What if the real war crime is war? Oh, wash your mouth out, Kevin. Frustration this week about the filthy rich of the filthy rich and would-be filthy rich from True Blue Aussie Securities and Investment Con Mission Supremo Joe Longo, real name, that despite insider trading carrying a 15-year jail sentence, judges his side go soft on these corporate crooks. Suspended sentences and good behaviour bonds for making heaps and heaps from insider trading. Perhaps 10-year-old and upward terra nullius non-land, non-people, hardened criminal children should investigate getting into a bit of insider trading and keep themselves out of jail. Suspended sentence, good behaviour bond for stealing thousands, jail for a pittance. But I raise this because obviously what may at face value look like insider trading is clearly anything but. Because who for one second would think that US OBS Secretary for War for Being Offensive and Train Killing Pete Hug Killstuff ordering his broker to buy up Merchant of Death shares 2 days before the US OBS invaded Iran would have anything to do with insider trading? Just pure coincidence. because Pete loves the dear baby Jesus and knows the dear baby blesses and loves every piece of merchandise those merchants of death churn out. But the good guy merchandise, of course, he hates the same merchandise in the hands of the bad guys, showing how the merchants of death themselves maintain a healthy balance in these matters. A very, very fortunate coincidence for Pete. And while we might think poor old Mother Earth is getting a bit of a reprieve from fossil destruction as fossil fuel supplies dwindle, all that merchandise slaughtering and destroying in evil Iran and evil Gaza and evil Lebanon and evil whoever Zion and Benjamin's US of puppet deem evil is offsetting that minor reprieve many, many times over. Figure this week with the first couple of days of bombing Iran into oblivion released millions of tons of CO2 into the atmosphere, contaminates the water supply and sets up a long-term ecological disaster. But good news, no disaster for the US of oil behemoths who are rubbing their oil-slicked, slippery hands together as they estimate the little fuel problem arising from Benjamin and Donald's toys for the boys' slaughter, sending oil prices through the roof, will reap them a $90 billion, real figure, $90 billion windfall profit over and above their normal windfall profit, which surely makes that major contribution to choking Mother Earth to death worth every billion. Indeed, our very own, or not exactly our very own, but the great pollution behemoths, helping True Blue Aussie extract gas and coal and a bit of oil and meeting their legal tax obligations, thanks to their legal tax lawyers and financial advisors, have come up with a bit of common sense, thanks to Benjamin and Donald's fuel crisis. We must pause plans to review the industrial emissions reduction policy and prioritise energy and fuel security over climate targets. The Minerals Profits Council, Supremo Tania Can Stable Profits, ordered the government. With global energy markets under pressure, taking a little more time is a sensible way to focus on fuel and energy security while avoiding unnecessary disruption. Tania was all common sense. What unnecessary disruption, Tania? Costly measures to reduce pollution, for instance, but only for a little more time. It's not that we're not committed to pollution reduction. Yes, we've noticed that, but how much little more time? Well, great corporate citizens like Woodside with profits and Santosas the profits et al., are so dedicated to the transition from themselves, they estimate it can be completed in as little as 70 years. So I'd say 70 years, little more time. The threat of pollution reduction isn't all that's threatening the poor pollution industry. We criticised the evil unions last week for threatening to unionise the long, long union-free Pilbara resource cornucopia. Well, next week, the evil ETU will start industrial action. Overtime ban, stoppages. The resource giants distress that reunionisation will threaten our margins. What a frightening thought, seeing those margins are so tight. We all know what little profit they make. Why, their taxes or non-taxes prove that. Although, finally, if unions representing workers would threaten our margins, surely this doesn't mean the union-free, keep evil unions out, win-win they boast is not quite the win bit for the workers. Surely not. Good morning.
Rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Our ship is sinking, but please don't panic. Playing a ride with me as we go sinking in the cold cruise sea, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, changing the weather, changing the sea, money to burn temporarily. The ice caps are melting, the ozone's thin. Put on your hat and your shades and let's begin. Rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Our ship is sinking, but please don't panic. Much worse, we're gonna die. Women and children first, don't cry. Rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. First class.
second class, third class more. The rich are rich and the rest are poor. You can't stop progress and stay afloat. You can change the curtains, but don't rock the boat. Rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Our ship is sinking, but please don't panic. Let's toast the future, take a sip. Follow the captain down to the ship. Rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Moving me to destiny on our ship of fools, sail along with me. Rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Our ship is sinking, but please don't panic. The band playing nearer, my God to thee, as we go sailing to eternity. Rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Mick Conway and Rearranging the Deck Chairs on the Titanic. And we've got Don Sutherland on the line. G'day, Don. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Annie. And g'day to you and all your listeners.
Remind listeners that you were here last week having a chat about the National Wage case and how important it is for the lowest waged people in Australia, but it also has knock-on effects to the other parts of society. But today we're going to look at the obverse of the coin and about profits.
Yes, well, the annual wage review is indeed, just to make one brief recapitulation point, or a recap point, is one of the three decisive decisions made periodically, in this case once a year, that set the standard of living for a minimum of nearly 3 million workers with flow-on effect indirectly to many others. An old rule, of course, in many discussions we've had is you can't discuss wages without discussing profits. So, Annie, what if I said to you and your listeners that Australia's profitability, rate of profit, was in around 2020-21, about 7% and falling. In other words, there is a profitability problem in Australia, and it is caused by primarily by new technological investment.
Could you explain that?
Yes, well, the rate of profit, the real rate of profit, is the total profits divided by the total wages plus the capital invested. And there are three or four different ways of measuring that. I won't get into those weeds today. The latest research, highly credible, out of a young political economist, Kulya Karambakhsh, in the University of Sydney, he has done a lot of work, highly credible and being widely cited, on the world rate of profit, which shows a steady decline in the world rate of profit. That is, the capitalist system has got a problem with its own primary indicator. And that has flow-on effect to two big deal things.
What you're saying, before we go on, what you're saying is that capitalism, as if it was a car, it would consider that it's chugging along okay if it's got petrol in the tank and it's shooting out power. It's profit.
What's happening is that it's in crisis because of its own contradictions. If you invest more, if we expect employers to invest more productively, that in the first instance puts downward pressure on the rate of profit, which is what they are primarily interested in. That's what motivates them all of the time, every minute of the day.
Yes, so for everybody else, it's the running of society and the maintenance of a way of life. But for the capitalists, it's really just about profit.
Just about profits. And the spin-off effects, of course, is the harm that the solution to that problem does to to the overall standard of living and, of course, to nature. What I'm calling nowadays the ecological chasm between humanity and the rest of nature. So the solution, the capitalist solution to the problem that their system generates, which is a downward in profitability, is harmful for everything else. And that comes into sharp relief, actually, in the annual wage review. And I would say that probably in many other countries where the details are different, but the same problem presents itself. Now, so here's the big question. If there is, as Pooja Currumbach says and basically proves in his research, if it says that there is a downward pressure on the rate of profit, a critical feature of the society we live in, does that mean we should moderate our wage claims?
Yeah, but ultimately it wouldn't make any difference because the wage claims would just become minuscule and people wouldn't be able to actually live.
Yes, well, the...
That's the obvious logical outcome of that statement.
That's one of the obvious contradictions that then emerges.
Yeah, well, capitalism is a cannibal, basically.
Who's going to buy the product that gets produced? The wages goods that get produced, these are the goods that are paid for out of wages. They're going to be overproduced, aren't they? Until something happens to destroy a lot of the existing capital. And what does that the best? Well, there's two things that do it extra well, and that is global heating-driven disasters that destroys capital and therefore, in the first instance, kicks off a reversal in the decline in the rate of profit. And the second thing, of course, is war.
I was going to say, is this why we're having this war at the moment?
So we go back to a basic, some very basic stuff about the society we live in, and its contradictions are as relevant today as they were when the system first developed in the late 18th century. So what does it mean for the annual wage? How do we jump to that? Well, the first thing is that the particular measure of profitability that we've been talking about, which is obsessed over by every single employer, they obsess over it because if their competitors have got a better rate of profit than they are, they know they're in trouble. So in order to compete, they have to somehow or other get the rate of profit up. And that means an increase in the rate of exploitation of workers. And that takes us to what the employers are saying and what the unions are saying in their submissions to the annual wage review. That provides, now none of that particular way of measuring profitability is absolutely silent in the annual wage review discussions and submissions. There are a sort of indirect references to aspects of it, but it is not grappled with by anybody because they all accept that they all want the current society to continue. The unions just want a fairer go within it. Fairer. You can't get a fair go within it, but you might be able to get a fairer go, so to speak, if you're if you've got a good policy, a proposal, a good strategy. And the employers, of course, are desperate to increase the rate of exploitation because that means that they'll make more profit out of the physical investment they've made.
So it sounds like a disaster, doesn't it? It sounds like the Titanic.
Well, it's riven with contradictions and it's no good. People, we've got to be careful sort of putting it like that because this has been trending for a very long time. And generally speaking, particularly in Australia, it has not led to a powerful push against the sinking of the Titanic. Hmm. It's been more along the lines of using all the technology available to plug the hole in it.
Yes, yes.
In other words, the system has continued. As destructive as it has been, it continues to be given, to use the current jargon, a social license to continue.
Well, going back to something you said just a bit earlier, it's kind of interesting to reflect that this system that we're living in actually had a beginning, which was the 18th century, as you were saying. So,
well, it matured significantly. There were signs of it before that, of course, but it matured to a very significant level with all the major features established around that time, yes.
Yeah, which of course means that because people have all been living in it for such a long time, there's this idea that it's impossible for the world to be in a different state. And it kind of reminds me of that Ursula Le Guin famous quote about people used to think that God kings couldn't be eliminated, but of course things have changed.
Yes. Well, I think the thing is that the main point is that there is still not, you know, a majority sentiment that's anywhere near strong enough to change the system. But there are is in that direction. And, of course, there have been examples in the past and still being pursued practically in the present, which is one reason why Trump wants to destroy, or Trump and the socio-political religious class, part of the capitalist class around him, want to get destroy Culver as it currently is and get it back, because they can't tolerate a society that has democratic socialist characteristics on their doorstep. That's another separate discussion. Let's return to the annual wage review. Now, in the annual wage review, the first step is the submissions, as we discussed last week. And there are a lot of economic indicators that are used by both the employers and the unions to justify their claims. And remember, the ACT claim is 5% plus, and I did not really properly address this last week. The second part of the ACTU submission is that the national minimum wage for workers on junior the national minimum wage be set at what is called the C12 level and its equivalent in all of it. So the C12 level is in the manufacturing award, and then there are equivalents in every one of the other 122 awards. I think it's 123 altogether. There is an equivalent there. And so the new national national minimum wage would be at that speed 12 level. Now, by memory, that's another 5% increase. All right? Now, yeah. They say comfortable with it being phased in. So, in fact, for workers on minimum wage, it's more than a 5% claim. It's a 5% plus claim. And then the third part of it is the support to get rid of junior rates for workers who are 18 years or older. And junior rates, and to raise the regular apprenticeship to the adult rate. So there are those aspects of the claims that are very, if successful, very beneficial for the lowest paid. And I didn't quite cover all of those properly last week.
Yeah, okay.
But the ACT then used the essence of the ACTU economics in its submission is that it tries, if you like, to hoist the commission on its own petard. In other words, it seeks to use all of the economic arguments that the commission made last year, the 2005-26 decision, which brought in a disappointingly low increase. But they say that all of the arguments that the commission used last year justify a 5% increase. So, and at the heart of that is that the claim is affordable. In other words, by meeting the 5% plus the other elements, won't do harm to things like overall profits, business investment, inflation, and so on. And I think this is worth emphasising. Of the claims that I've read so far, and I've studied more closely obviously the ACT claim and also the Australian Industry Group claim, theirs is usually the most credible of the employers.
So what did you find?
And the ACT claim overall is easily the most substantial claim. In terms of within the restrictions that it expects and in mounting that case that the Fair Work Commission itself, its economic, are the arguments in favour of a 5% increase.
One of the most interesting things about the thing you just said about the ACTU's claim is that it is couched in the terms of the employer's needs, as opposed to the workers' needs, I would have thought.
No, I don't think that's fair. It's couched in what they are willing to accept is the needs of the economy overall, and they say that, therefore, if you look at that in the way they do, the 5% is entirely justifiable. And within the restrictions of that argument, without taking into account the big issue, which we've already discussed about the rate of profit, within the framework of that argument, they produce very substantial material.
It's kind of interesting because at the moment, a whole range of corporations, like, say, for example, Telstra, for example, and this is just a straw poll, like my phone has now been, costs have now been increased again, $5 for no reason at all. Like every year they just increase the amount that you have to pay for their service. Yes. And there's a whole range of services that are exactly the same. So, for example, gas. It costs me more to have it connected than it does for the amount of gas I actually use.
Yeah.
There's a whole range of things that corporations and capitalism have set in stone that continually keep increasing for people who basically have very limited income?
One of the laws of running businesses is that if you've got the power and the opportunity arises, get ahead with price gouging.
Well, the economy, the government and the economy don't appear to be dealing with those issues when it comes to things like the national wage case. You know, like they've got levers, and the national wage case is one of those levers, but then it's within the framework of a larger economy.
Well, it might be hard to believe, but the ACTU submission doesn't deal extensively price gouging yet. I want to come back to that point. But it does deal with the impact of corporate pricing on the standard of living in quite a safe way, like quite a helpful way. Keeping in mind that everything I'm saying now is about what they're saying inside the restrictions, what's required by the annual wage, the statutory requirements.
Yeah, we have to finish, I'm afraid, because it's come to the end of the program. But when do they come? When is it announced? When is the Fair Work Commission going to announce its outcome?
Well, the decision is usually announced in around mid-June, and that's so that whatever they award, it can be applied in the first full pay period of
the new year, the new financial year.
In July.
Yeah.
Now, the critical dates, and I don't have them all in front of them, so I'm going by memory. I think there's about another fortnight before reply submission, and this is where the ACT says what it wants to say about what's wrong and misleading in the employer's submissions, and the same thing with the employers. And then that might see also some new content from the ACTU and the employers about the impact of the war.
Okay.
And then on May the 9th, after the budget, there is a new set of submissions, so that those who are making submissions can. Now, that makes May Day a big deal. Do we make this issue a big deal at the annual one? Past practice says no one really gets it. They don't understand the impact on the standard of living.
We really have to wind up, Don.
Yeah, and then there's a final face-to-face one-day meeting in the commission building in Sydney, and that led on to the decision, as I said, in mid-June.
Okay, thank you very much for your time, and we'll catch up with you soon, okay?
Learn the decision. Don't learn the submissions.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's it for Solidarity Breakfast this morning. Coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. We'll go out with Birdie King, Love Is the Only Thing.
Is the only thing that matters at all after all. soul. Love is the only thing that matters at all.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.